So this week is, as I'm sure you've noticed, Sexual Health Awareness Week. And it's been devoted to exploring how we deal with issues surrounding sexual health, both on campus and in the wider world. So today I'm going to look at how past societies have dealt with these issues. The subtitle of this lecture is Sexual Health Through the Ages, but this, I should point out, is in no way comprehensive, and I'll be focusing mostly on European societies, and chronologically I'll be concentrating on the period from about 1500 to 1900. So I want to focus today on how past societies have dealt with the same questions we are dealing with today: the prevention and cures of sexually transmitted diseases, and the issues and pitfalls of safe sex. Though much of it will seem amusing to our modern selves, so proud of our biomedical understanding of such diseases, we must be careful not to patronise the past understandings or approaches. Despite our confidence in bacterial organisms and biomedical cures, we have not eradicated these diseases. Infection rates for STIs are on the increase in our society, and not to mention the fact that we are witnessing the unprecedented human health crisis of HIV and AIDS. So before we scoff too readily at the past, we must keep in mind the deficiencies of the present. After saying that, we can commence the scoffing, of course. So today we can break down sexually transmitted diseases into fairly distinct conditions. They can all be attributed to the workings of their specific causative organism, shown here, and all follow much the same course from infection to diagnosis, prognosis and cure, unchanged from person to person. However, up until the very late 19th century, diseases were not so easily distinguished, and we certainly cannot talk of them in these terms. In fact, I'm going to start with a disease that was recognised as specifically prone to changing form and even developing into other diseases. We now know it as syphilis, but it has had a great many names before this. Now, historians have taken great relish, traditionally, in retrospectively diagnosing all and sundry with what we now call syphilis. I, of course, am above this practice, so I'm going to concentrate on the average early modern sufferer of the disease, what was available to guard them against this infection, and how they dealt with it. So, we begin then 515 years ago in 1494. A new disease is sweeping Europe, highly virulent and destructive. It produces lesions on the groin, rashes on the skin, damages the bones and disrupts the body's four humours, eventually ending in debility, madness and death. It is referred to by a vast number of medical and colloquial terms, amongst them the pox, the secret disease, lous venerea, but most commonly at this time, morbus gallicus, i.e. the French disease. This woodcut from 1496, thought to be by Albrecht Dürer, is one of the first visual depictions of the pox sufferer. To this picture's German audience, this unfortunate sufferer would have been easily recognisable as a French fop, which is exactly the sort of person who was thought to be responsible for the spread of the disease. Incidentally, during this period, the French referred to it as the Italian disease. European contemporaries postulated that this disease had been brought back to the continent from the Americas with the returning Columbus, and from there it quickly made its way across Europe. From its earliest appearances, it was recognised as being transmitted primarily through sexual contact, causing a great deal of moralising consternation. In London in 1579, one surgeon wrote, I quote, "The cause whereof I see none so great as the licentious and beastly behaviour of a great number of rogues and vagabonds, the filthy life of which many lewd and idle persons, men and women, about the city of London." So it was widely believed during the early years of the French pox that this was a punishment sent by God, lending a special emphasis to the idea of this disease as one afflicting the immoral. So this image shows the Virgin and Child raining down this disease on these poor unfortunates in the corner. This image actually appeared in a variety of manifestations throughout the 16th century. In this version, we see a more merciful Jesus actually healing these unfortunates here. But this guy at the bottom has not been so lucky, unfortunately, and is dead. So as the disease took a firm hold on European societies, medical and lay opinion stated that it could be transmitted from person to person via kissing, sharing drinks, breastfeeding, sharing beds, toilet seats, and even trying on each other's gloves. though some physicians claimed many of these were excuses from those who were embarrassed by their own lewd behaviour. But never fear. Embarrassment aside, from the early modern sufferer of the pox, there was hope yet for a cure. Unfortunately, this came in the form of mercury. This was administered to the pox patient in a number of ways. Topically, in the form of ointments or salves. Orally, as a pill. It could be injected, or even through fumigation. Here, the patient would be put on a restricted diet for several days or weeks before the procedure, then covered in a mercurial salve, wrapped tightly in blankets, and placed in this fumigation chamber here. And this produced a copious sweating, which was supposed to be signs of the pox leaving the body. However, the effects of mercury on the patient were not limited to the terrible sweating it produced. Doses were often so high that the jaw and tongue would ulcerate, gums would swell, teeth would be loosened, saliva constantly dribbled from the mouths of the sufferers, and their breath became almost unbearably foul. So, understandably, many of the poxed chose to avoid treatment by mercury and either suffer the effects of the disease in silence or turn to one of the many quack remedies peddled by unlicensed practitioners. This cartoon shows the fury of the advocates of mercury over here against a new herbal-based syrup by this guy here, Mr. Swainson. And I have to say, if faced with a choice between mercurial sweating and something called a syrup, I know where I would be going. So I mentioned earlier that during the early modern period, we cannot talk of sexually transmitted diseases in the same specifically distinct terms as today. The nature of diseases such as the pox were constantly changing form from person to person, depending on their own individual balance of the four humours. However, in the 18th century, there was much debate as to the specificity of the pox, which was now increasingly at this point becoming referred to as syphilis, in relation to another disease we might recognise today, gonorrhea, more commonly referred to as the clap. In the mid-18th century, arguments between medical practitioners as to whether gonorrhea and syphilis shared the same common virus looked to be unresolvable until London surgeon and overeager experimenter John Hunter transferred some pus taken from a gonorrheal sore of one of his patients to his own penis.
Oh my God.
Unluckily for Hunter, and I think you can see the regret in his face, he not only contracted gonorrhea but also syphilis. In fact, it persuaded him that the two diseases must share a common virus, and it led to mercury being introduced as a cure for gonorrhea too. His theory was later disproved fairly resolutely in the mid-19th century, long after he had died in considerable pain. Of course, it was not just those infected with the pox, gonorrhea, the clap, gleets, or any of the many venereal diseases doing the rounds in the 18th century who had to be worried. Those who had avoided these diseases wished to continue to do so. And as the old adage goes, prevention is better than cure. So I now turn to the prophylactic part of the talk. There is actually little archaeological evidence for the condom in the ancient world, though it is often asserted that the ancient Egyptians used a linen sheath to guard against sexually transmitted diseases. There are similar mentions of the Chinese wrapping silk paper around the penis, and ancient Japanese cultures using sheaths made, uncomfortably enough, from leather and tortoise shell. The first mention of the condom in the period discussed today comes from the work of a 16th century surgeon, Gabriel Fallopia, in a work on the French pox. Fallopia says, quote, "As often as a man has intercourse, he should, if convenience permits, wash his genitals or wipe them over with a cloth. Afterwards, he should use a small linen cloth made to fit over the glands. It would be as well to moisten it with saliva." End quote. Other medical writers advised soaking this linen sheath in a medicinal solution, then letting it dry out before using it. And the earliest examples of these found have been dated to about 1646 and would look something like that. It should probably go without saying that these were also fully reusable. So by the 18th and 19th centuries, condoms were mostly being made from animal products, which is a nice way of saying intestines. One 19th century instruction for making such a device runs thusly. Quote, "The appendix of a sheep, soaked for some hours in water, turned inside out, macerated again in weak alkaline lye, changed every 12 hours, scraped carefully to abstract the mucous membrane, leaving the peritoneal and muscular coats, then exposed to the vapour of burning brimstone, washed with soap and water, blown up, dried, cut to a length of 7 to 8 inches, bordered at the open end with a ribbon." Nice sliver. But not for nothing was one slang term for the condom the English overcoat. English trade in condoms flourished in the 18th and 19th century, especially in London. Adverts for condom shops were in circulation around the city by the 19th century, informing customers helpfully that to guard yourself from shame and fear, votaries to Venus hasten here. None in our wares e'er found a flaw. Self-preservation's nature's law. Aside from the condom, there are a wealth of herbal remedies that claim to prevent transmission of the pox during sex. As well, of course, as that old and slightly unimaginative favourite, abstinence. But it is not just sex with other people that can land you clapped, poxed or dead. No, we must also be mindful of the heinous sin of self-pollution. Yes, even masturbation, surely the safest of sex, can lead to illness, decrepitude and eventually death. At least it could in the 18th and 19th centuries. The ancient medical authorities were largely quiet on the dangers of masturbation. There are even references in Galen advocating the practice to get rid of excess fluids which could play havoc with the body's humours. This was especially important for women as they are by nature colder and moister than men. Indeed, for the ancient Greeks, masturbation was more often treated as a potentially embarrassing joke. This is a good example of this tongue-in-cheek attitude. I'm not sure if you can quite make it out, but this vase at the top shows three satyrs masturbating quite vigorously, and they each have names. The one in the middle translates as shaft pleasure, and the one on the right is called dophios, which is from the Greek that means to knead oneself. So there are numerous mentions of this solitary pastime throughout time and across cultures, but it was the early 18th century in Western Europe when an era of what is now termed masturbation panic set in, and it really became bad for your health. In about 1712, an anonymously authored book appeared in England called Onania. This title referenced the biblical story of Onan, who, after his brother died, became wrapped up in quite the moral quandary over whether he should, as tradition dictated, sleep with his brother's wife. The Bible says it better than me, so I quote again, "And Onan knew that the seed should not be his, and it came to pass that when he went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also." Which could be construed as a slight overreaction, but there we go. So the linking of Onan's crime, spilling his seed, with the practice of masturbation was new at this time, and the book sparked quite the moral panic around Europe. Its overall attitude towards masturbation could be seen quite clearly in its full title, Onania, or the heinous sin of self-pollution, and all its frightful consequences, in both sexes considered, with spiritual and physical advice to those who have already injured themselves by this abominable practice, and seasonable admonition to the youth of both sexes, and those tuition who they are under, whether parents, guardians, masters, or mistresses. Brevity was not a feature of the 18th century. Onania was a rambling collection of loosely theological, moralising diatribes, but it was taken up by the medical community, especially one French physician, Tissot, who wrote his own tract on masturbation in 1766, which he titled Onanism, or A Treatise on the Disorders Produced by Masturbation. That title also goes on for a long time. In this work, Tissot asserted that the body was kept healthy by a balance of fluids, and that frequent evacuations of any kind left it bereft of nutrition and wasting away. Tissot was especially opposed to the evacuations caused by masturbation, So convinced of was he of its debilitating consequences that he called the practice simply an act of suicide. His advice was to abstain from the practice completely to avoid this waste of vital fluids. And this was especially important for men, as Tissot argued that it was semen that caused the muscles to thicken and the beard to grow. And this, by the way, is Tissot, and I'm sure you've noticed. So here we have the typical 18th century masturbator. In describing the symptoms of masturbation, Tissot and his contemporaries were not shy, saying variously that they are often out of breath, appear aged, have difficulty walking, hear noises in their ears, their bodies are bent, their legs are bent, they become stupid and lazy, they suffer epilepsy, lethargy, fainting, loss of sight, gout, hysteria, stomach cramps, they are constantly thinking about sex or masturbating and will eventually die in terrible agony. It could even lead to developing venereal diseases such as syphilis or gonorrhea. Not a good position to be in. The effects of masturbation also happened quickly. Here we have a youthful and virtuous girl, aged 15, and yet, after only a year as a masturbator, here she is again. It doesn't bear thinking about. And here we have a young man in the prime of life, and yet, just a short while later, after taking up this hideous practice, here he is again, fighting death. And this doesn't even end here. After a short while later, having not learned his lesson, he is now suffering from the pox. So, though the prognosis was, in Tissot's own words, often very dreadful, there were cures abound, and Tissot gives one particularly long-winded one. So, to quote, give him an emetic, repeat it in order to purge his head. The cure should be begun in spring. After purgatives, give him scummed or ass's milk, then cow milk for 40 days. While he drinks the milk, he should eat no meat. And at night, he should take water gruel. After leaving off milk, he should eat the most tender meats, beginning with a small quantity only. By this means, he will regain his flesh. For a whole 12 months after, he should avoid every kind of debauchery, all venereal practice, and every other immoderate exercise. And in his walks, he should equally avoid cold and being in the sun, which I don't think leaves much to do. And the moral and medical panic about masturbation was not confined to the 18th century. It continued well into the 19th, producing many theories on how to deal with and treat the threat of the masturbator. 19th century physician, vegetarian and cereal magnate John Harvey Kellogg has much to say on the subject, deeming it completely immoral and dangerous to health. However, magnanimous as he was, Kellogg did not only give us a delicious way to start the day, but also a great deal of advice on emphatically how to not start the day. Kellogg advised the sufferer of the solitary sin to, quote, resolve to reform now, not tomorrow or next week, but this very minute. Thousands have sunk to perdition while resolving to indulge only once more. However, if willpower alone was not enough, Kellogg was also kind enough to provide a stricter remedy. A remedy which is always successful, he says, in small boys, is circumcision. The operation should be performed by a surgeon without administering an anaesthetic, as the brief pain attending the operation will have a salutary effect upon the mind. In females, the author has found that the application of pure carbolic acid to the clitoris an excellent means of allaying the abnormal excitement. Well, quite. So that treat of advice was taken from Kellogg's Plain Facts for Old and Young, which is a massive tract dealing with the myriad dangers that accompany sex in all its many disgusting forms, not even just masturbation. But if surgery and acid were still not enough, there was a myriad devices around at the time to aid the chronic masturbator in his or her quest to return to morality. From these anti-masturbation corsets for both men and women, to more brutal-looking devices. The I'll let you use your imagination to work out what those were used for. The 19th century was not short of helping hands to tame their own wandering hands. So, that's basically me. But so from poxed patients riddled with mercury poisoning to Victorian onanists, the history of sexual health practices has been plagued with pain and strife for the unfortunate sufferers. Today, though this may seem a little smug, it is relatively painless. So I'll end by reinforcing one of the main messages of Sexual Health Awareness Week and say, go and get tested. Yay! There's no acid, there's no mercury, and there's no corsets involved.